Even conservative columnist George Will recently expressed his surprise that absolutely zero pro-sustainability legislation has been passed since Barack Obama was sworn in as President of the United States. The recent Copenhagen Climate Change Conference is widely accepted as being a failure. It seems reasonably clear that sustainability will not catch on soon enough in a big enough way worldwide to make any significant difference in avoiding various unpleasant outcomes. It seems most of the sustainability movement is concerned about climate change, which is certainly something to be concerned about, but it now appears that there are two other issues whose impact may soon become larger than the early impacts of climate change, which are already apparent. These issues are resource depletion, especially peak oil, and the ongoing international financial situation, which seems to take two steps backward for every tentative step forward. I recently found a paper by a peak oil expert named Gail Tverberg. I don't know how to pronounce her last name. Anyway, she can explain the situation far better than I ever could. I got her permission to quote and reprint her work in its entirety. So forgive me for reading this text out loud this morning, but I simply can't imagine a better way to explain our near-term predicament. I will now quote from Gail Tverberg's paper, which has the rather lengthy name of Systemic Risk Arising from a Financial System That Requires Growth in a World with Limited Oil Supply. So here we go. It seems to me that if we are, in fact, reaching limits with respect to oil supply, this should be of considerable concern. We have a financial system that demands economic growth for reasons that will be discussed later in this paper. At the same time, as we approach limits with respect to oil production, the ability of the world's economy to grow becomes constrained, because in order for economic growth to occur, we will need to do more and more with less and less oil. The conflict of these two forces, a need for economic growth in a world that can no longer provide growing oil supply, sets the financial system up for a systemic risk of collapse. Furthermore, there is significant evidence that the financial problems of 2008 were early signs of this systemic risk affecting the financial system. If oil supply should actually begin to decline in the future, we can expect financial problems such as those in 2008 to return and to worsen. This next section she titles Oil's Connection to the Economy. Oil is used for a huge number of purposes: transportation fuel, heating fuel, fuel for extracting minerals of all types, lubricants, and raw material for asphalt for road paving, plastics, synthetic cloth, medicines, fertilizer, pesticides, and herbicides, to name a few things. I'm going to interject a little quote here. There was once an executive from one of the big oil companies who said this off the record, so he didn't want his name attached to it, but he said, using the miracle of hydrocarbon crude oil for transportation fuel is like you burning a Picasso painting for heat, because hydrocarbons are amazing chemicals, and the fact that we're just burning up all of them to drive our living rooms from point A to point B is just seems ridiculous, even to him who's working in a big oil company. Anyway, let me get back to Gail's paper. A declining oil supply, or even a level supply, then, should be a serious concern given that the world's population continues to increase and more of the world's lower classes begin to come up economically and begin to use more oil in China and India. In recent years, there have been many attempts to try and find substitutes for oil, but with very limited success. Ethanol from corn has probably been the biggest success, but in 2009, its use in the United States amounted to only 660,000 barrels per day, compared to total consumption of oil products of 18.8 million barrels a day. Or in other words, ethanol was 3.5% of the total. Raising this percentage is proving difficult for several reasons. Manufacturers' warranties only permit the use of 10% ethanol in gasoline, and ethanol tends to be more expensive than gasoline without subsidies. And there are relatively few stations offering E85 gasoline. I just want to interject that with rising food prices, I don't know how much more farmland we can afford to convert to ethanol production. Back to Gail's paper. Other so-called replacements for oil are only very partial replacements and are still very far away from being full-scale solutions. Biofuel from algae is being investigated, but is still very expensive and not yet scalable. Electric cars are being developed, but they still are many years from being ready to replace our huge fleet of automobiles based on the internal combustion engine. It should be noted that the problem with oil supply is really an economic one. There is a huge amount of oil theoretically available in the oil sands in Canada, for example, and in the oil shale in the United States West, and perhaps even in the Middle East. But in order for this oil to be available now, huge investments would need to have been made starting at least 10 years ago. Also, in order to justify this investment, the cost of the finished oil products would need to be very high, high relative to the energy required to extract the oil, and high relative to people's salaries. At some point, limits are reached in the amount that people can afford to pay for oil, and we may already be approaching those limits. Many observers would like us to believe that limits on oil and other resources are still a long way off, but this is not really true. World crude oil production has already stopped rising. Oil production has been essentially flat from 2005 to 2010, in spite of that huge run-up in prices we had back in 2008, meaning that more and more cars and trucks must compete for the same fuel supply. Higher oil prices can lead to recession and debt defaults. High oil prices don't give ordinary citizens more salary to spend, so they have to cut back on something else. One possibility is a cutback in discretionary spending, which will tend to lead to recession. If the cutback is in buying new homes, the price of new homes can be expected to drop. James Hamilton wrote a paper called Causes and Consequences of the Oil Shock of 2007-08, showing that the run-up in oil prices in the years prior to 2008 was sufficient to cause the major recession that we have recently experienced. If oil prices rise, they may also cause debt defaults. This occurs because people's salaries don't rise correspondingly, so they need to cut back somewhere, and some will default on debts. Business may also be more at risk of debt defaults if their cash flow is declining. The lower values of homes may also play a role in the increasing defaults. While one cannot prove that the aforementioned problems are the only causes of the financial crisis of 2008, there is certainly a strong similarity between the expected problems and the types of problems that we have recently seen. It should be noted, too, that a seeming oversupply of oil should not be surprising. Right now, there is an oversupply of oil. Oil stocks are very high at this point in time. As higher prices give rise to recession, this causes a cutback in demand. Reduction in credit availability also tends to reduce demand. So the oil available may be more expensive than what individuals and businesses can afford. If the oil available were cheaper, the oversupply would disappear. For example, we've gotten used to $3 a gallon gasoline. If it went back to the $2 a gallon that we had prior to the big price run-up in 2007, I'm sure these oversupplies would not last long. It's just that to supply oil at the level we have now, it needs to cost $3 a gallon. And let's get back to the economic system's need for growth. Our current economic system includes a huge amount of debt. Money is loaned into existence. That just floored me, by the way, when I first learned that. I still can't get over that. But anyway, let's go back to her paper. Debt is used to finance many business expansions. Governments rely heavily on debt. The U.S. economy has been growing for many years, with only brief interruptions, so nearly all of our experience with borrowing money and paying it back with interest has been during periods of economic growth. Borrowing from the future is relatively easy when the economy is growing because when the time comes to pay back the debt, the debtor's economic condition is likely to be as good as it was when the loan was taken out and may be even better. So defaults are relatively uncommon, and the growth in the economy between the time the loan was taken out and the time it is repaid provides some contribution towards the interest payments. But what if we start encountering a very different kind of world, one with a decline in energy supplies? If oil resources constrain economic growth, debt defaults can be expected to rise, and the whole debt system underlying our financial system is at risk. Insurance companies are very much at risk, too, because many of their assets are bonds. In the past, these bonds would have been repaid with interest, but in a world with little economic growth and perhaps economic decline, the risk of default becomes much greater. Even if we should discover a way around our problems, say some new technology which permits more oil extraction at lower cost or a better substitute for oil, financial institutions, including insurance companies, are still likely to encounter substantial systemic risk related to debt defaults in the next few years. So that's the end of Gail Tverberg's paper. Next, I would like to quote from Chris Martinson, who used to be a highly paid vice president working for a Fortune 300 company. It was Pfizer Pharmaceuticals. But he quit that job and now spends all of his time warning to whoever will listen that we should prepare for the upcoming 20 years to be completely unlike the past 20 years. It would appear that other corporate insiders are also worried. Now, here's a rather interesting statistic that I found. For the week of October 4th, 2010, the insider selling to buying ratio was 2,341 shares sold for each share purchased. So insiders are in that week of October the 4th sold $400 million worth of stock and in return bought a measly $170,000. This comes on the heels of the September 27th week, where it had an equally insanely bearish ratio of $1,411 of shares sold to every $1 purchased, which, by the way, if you go back a week before that, the ratio was 250-1. If you go back the week before that, the insider ratio was a sell-off of 650-1. So in plain terms, corporate insiders, the folks who know their business and its prospects better than anyone, are dumping their shares as fast as is legally possible. But, you know, I digress from what Chris Martinson says. Let's get back to it. Chris says, and I quote, "It is my informed opinion that there is no fix to our current predicament. There are only outcomes to be managed." Now, I want to say that again because that sentence is the main point that I'm trying to convey in this morning's message. Let me read that again. It is, Chris Martinson says, that it is my informed opinion that there is no fix to our current predicament. There are only outcomes to be managed. In other words, taking political action to try and sustain our current way of life is likely a waste of time because business as usual simply cannot be sustained for much longer, and we need to prepare both mentally and physically for a very different future. How long do we have? Well, I'll quote from a certain member of the United States Congress who shall remain nameless since our private conversation was off the record. He said, "An economic collapse could happen tomorrow, or it could happen 10 years from now. But what's certain is that it is inevitable, given the course that we are on right now." But again, I digress from Chris Martinson's message, so let me continue to quote from him. "Unless some brand new energy source is discovered, preferably about 15 years ago and prosecuted with all due haste, the necessary liquid fuels will not be there to power enough new economic development to cover all the past debts and unfunded promises. Well, this does not necessarily mean the end of the world. For many, it will certainly mean the end of the world as they know it." Now, this is not some future prediction. It is already reality for many people. Just look at the record number of uninsured Americans. Look at the number of pensioners relying on busted pension funds that have almost no chance of being able to pay out on their obligations. The unemployed, look at the number of unemployed over 50 years old who fear never working again. Look at the record number of people hit with foreclosures and repossessions. The number of people on food stamps is now at an all-time high of 40.8 million people. Lying just beneath these headlines are stories of hardship and difficulty writ large. Of course, even these dismal and predominantly United States statistics pale when compared to the pain being experienced in Greece, Ireland, Iceland, Spain, and Portugal, and soon enough, the United Kingdom, France, Japan, and the United States. As I've mentioned previously, this is Chris Martinson speaking, developing your personal resilience, putting on your oxygen mask first, is your number one priority. This puts you in a stronger position to assist others if or when the time comes. But the transitions that are coming will be physically and emotionally challenging for many, and this is where community comes in. Yes, we can individually prepare our root cellars and our portfolios, and we should. But the most important work is going to rest with our abilities to help and rely on others. For some, the pieces are already fully in place with intact communities and deep relationships. But for others, and I would dare say for most others, almost everything needs to be created from scratch. And I want to interject. This is where I think that the Boise Unitarian Universalist Fellowship needs to step in and really play an active role, is to be there for people who need to be part of a community even though they have nothing. In spite of all of our economic difficulties, the last thing that we want to see suffer is the Boise Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. It needs to be here, and it needs to be strong, because it is going to be very much needed, I am convinced, at some point in time within the next 10 years. So back to Chris's message. For the people impacted by the events in the headlines above, the need for emotional support can easily outweigh the need for physical items. Thinking of your resilience strategy in terms of we instead of I is not only necessary, but actually quite desirable. There are many reasons to enhance the quality and quantity of your relationships and network. Emotional support, learning new things. It's very hard to learn new things by yourself. If you're part of a larger group, you can buy in bulk. These are all good reasons. But perhaps the most important reason is the feeling of being part of a movement. History has proven again and again that real, systemic change rarely happens from the top down through presidents, prime ministers, congresses, and parliaments, but from the outside in. You will need community more than ever, so it's time to get started. That's the end of Chris Martinson's message. Now, of course, a disruptive future is not a certainty. You know, who is it that said predicting, making predictions is hard, especially about the future? So what are the odds of all of this coming to pass? Nate Hagans is someone who wrote an interesting article on that. I'll quote from him. Nate Hagans says that, given the constraints in natural resources, our currently unprecedented levels of debt on a global scale, and the absence of ideas for the next grand leap forward for mankind, it seems plausible that we might have to bid adieu to economic growth. And not just for a year or two, but for a long time. Some models suggest the chances for steady economic growth after 2010 are below 10 to 20%. Now, even if you disagree with such low odds and put the probability for more growth to, say, 80%, doesn't it seem a bit irresponsible to not at least consider the other 20% probability? Not buying insurance for a risk that might hit you with some pretty negative consequences strikes me as not the best strategy. Consider that we buy house insurance, and there's only a 1.5 to 2% chance we'll have a significant claim over a 10-year period. We buy car insurance, and there's only a 3 to 4% chance we'll have a significant claim over a 10-year period. That's the end of the message from Nate Hagans. So I'll actually say a few things myself here for a change. It appears that there's not an insignificant chance that Let me say that again. It appears there's not an insignificant chance that there will be economic disruptions over the next 10 years. So how do we buy insurance for it? Well, unfortunately, it's not as easy as writing a check. It takes not only money, but time to build new skills and a new mindset. This is very difficult to do in isolation. I know, because I've been trying for the last several months. We need each other to accomplish this. So what should we be doing? First of all, we need to gather to offer each other support as we deal emotionally with these new realities. There are various stages of grief that we have to go through as we adjust ourselves to the possibility of future upheaval. Secondly, we need to make sure that if there are disruptions with our highly complex just-in-time supply chains, we will still have access to water, food, health and first aid, heat, power, and communications. So let me conclude now with the spiritually uplifting part of this message. There is a rice farmer in Japan who pays particularly close attention to these issues, and I really like to read what this rice farmer in Japan has to say. He says, "Preparing should be rewarding and fun. By rewarding, I don't just mean that you'll survive, but that the very activity will make your life richer. It's the process, not just the goal. Brainstorming, gardening, learning a skill, admiring the fruits of your labor, and making other preparations with your other community members should be something you look forward to, not dread. Sure, there's going to be a lot of hard work, but you should feel as though you've reached the summit of today's climb and be charged with exhilaration. Life is to be enjoyed. If there's no enjoyment, then we're nothing more than robots." End of quote. There is currently an adult religious education class led by myself and Webb Van Winkle exploring these issues in depth. Session 3 of 5 will be this Monday night in the junior high room at 7 p.m. It is not too late to join us. It will be fairly easy to catch up by watching the video material that we've covered so far. If you can't make the adult RE class, please let me know if you have an interest in buying some insurance by joining a group of us to brainstorm what we can do to mitigate the risks of the storms to come.